A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello, I'm William Hague. Welcome to The Story, and I'm going to be talking to the Prime Minister. This, of course, is not a normal political interview. I can't pretend to be impartial. I've been leader of the Conservative Party, the job that our Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak, now does. He took over the seat in Yorkshire that I represented for 26 years, and I like him, and he's a friend of mine. But I'm also going to ask him about some of the very serious problems that he faces, along with the Conservative Party and the country. So earlier this week, the team and I went to Downing Street to meet him. And of course, despite it being a pretty special occasion, we began the interview just like normal. So, Rishi, Prime Minister, we always start these podcasts with somebody's name and job title, so you have to explain who you are.
Right. Rishi Sunak, Prime Minister of the UK, but perhaps more importantly for this purpose, your successor as a Member of Parliament for Richmond and North Yorkshire.
Well, you are indeed my successor, and that is how we met, isn't it? That was nearly 10 years ago now, in an auction room in Leyburn, North Yorkshire, which is in the Richmond constituency. And that was the first time I ever saw you. We'd never met before. Actually, we didn't know each other before that. And I saw you come onto the stage trying to be my successor, the Conservative candidate. And I thought, well, this young man is going to go far, which is one of my better predictions in my life. And what were you thinking when you were looking? There was me sitting in the front row with two other former members of Parliament,
I remember it vividly.
Stalwarts. What were you thinking?
Well, I walked out onto that stage. And first of all, to your point, it was right. There were hundreds of people there because obviously we have a very active and wonderful local association. So there were just hundreds of people there who had come for the occasion and to take part in it. But what was for me the overriding memory was I was just completely intimidated because you and I had never met before, and obviously you're former party leader, foreign secretary, so you were sitting there in the front row. But next to you was Leon Britton, who obviously
your predecessor,
who was Margaret Thatcher's Home Secretary.
Mm-hmm.
And then next to him, I think Timothy Kitson, who was his predecessor.
Was Ted Heath's PPS.
Mm-hmm. And then I think a little bit along was another constituent of ours, Michael Jopling, who was Margaret Thatcher's Chief Whip and
Agriculture
Secretary. Mm-hmm. So all of you were there or thereabouts on the front row. And obviously, you and I had never met. I hadn't met any of them. So I walked out to hundreds of people and all of you sitting there as well. It was, overriding memory was one of being incredibly intimidated.
Anyway, you won. And there are all these, there's something in the water in Richmond, isn't there? The MPs go on to really senior office. But you won. And now you've gone on. You've done better than me. You have. I was leader of the opposition. You've become prime minister. So tell me, what is it like being Prime Minister?
Well, you're right, actually. There's a lot to live up to because I've had Leon as Home Secretary, you as Foreign Secretary and Leader. So it was, there is a lot to live up to. Like being Prime Minister, what's distinctive about this job compared to, say, being Foreign Secretary or Chancellor, as I was, is the variety. And your typical day is divided into probably at best half-hour chunks. And over the course of one day, you have to go from thing to thing to thing, and they can be completely different. You know, one minute you might be talking to a group of primary age school children who are visiting Downing Street for something or other. The next minute you're in a National Security Council meeting about, whether we should retaliate and how we will retaliate against strikes on our Navy vessels and UK ships in the Red Sea. And then you'll be talking to MPs, or you might have a statement in Parliament about something. And it's that the need to be able to go from thing to thing, all of which require a different approach, different mindset, and yet juggle everything in the back of your head while you're talking to a seven-year-old about, you know, maths and right. knowing that you've got to go and chair a National Security Council meeting in 20 minutes after that.
You've been doing it about, what, 18 months now. What has been the high point and the low point so far of being Prime Minister?
So the high point, if I'm being totally honest, was probably when I got to play cricket in the garden of number 10 with the T20 cricket team.
All right, that's a good high point.
That was fun for me. And, you know, I was, you know, some of the Sam Curran, Joss Butler, Chris Jordan were all there. And I was a massive cricket fan. To get to play cricket in your back garden with some of your heroes is obviously a highlight. On a more serious note, though, I think that one of the special things about this job is that I'm continually inspired by people I meet. And you meet the very best of humanity, I find, because, and the examples I always give are, it's people who have been through some tragedy in their lives. Something's happened to them or a member of their family, one of their loved ones. But what they have taken it upon themselves to do is to advocate for change, to campaign, mm-hmm. so that either that doesn't happen to someone else in the future, can't bring back their loved one, or that there should be more awareness of an issue or something like that. And I think when you meet people like that, no matter how bad my day is going, it's hard not to be inspired by that.
And the lowest point so far? What's the some of those national security decisions?
Yeah, I mean, those aren't low points. I mean, they weigh heavily on you more than are low points. I mean, look, there's professional challenges always. I mean, probably the toughest thing, you know, because you met my kids when they were, you know, tiny and 2 and 3. I mean, you know, I've got two young girls who mean the world to me, and mm-hmm. obviously doing these jobs, it's hard to balance being a good dad and doing the job well. And obviously you have to prioritise this job because it's an important job and you're doing it on behalf of the whole country. So, you know, not being there for them as much as any dad would like to be is a challenge. And there's particular moments where that you really feel that acutely because there's something very difficult going on that you just can't be there for them at. Yeah. And that's tough, but that's the job.
Well, talking of low points, we have to discuss the political situation, which of course is different. The thing we have in common, apart from being MPs for Richmond, Yorkshire, is both becoming at a young age leader of the Conservative Party. In my case, at probably the worst time ever in history to try to become leader of the Conservative Party, because it had just lost the 1997 election. You know, we'd lost half our seats, and I had to try to get the party going again. You maybe got elected at the second worst possible time to be leader of the Conservative Party. When, if it was a ship of state, it is, I can say this, you might not want to, your predecessor had got it onto the rocks. There was a financial storm going on. A crew had mutinied twice in the previous few months. Now, you know, in my opinion, you've then floated that ship off the rocks and you've got us out of the storm and you've calmed down a lot of the crew. But that's been a very difficult process, hasn't it? It's been a very hard time to be leader of the party.
Yeah, I think someone described it as the worst hospital pass for any incoming yes. prime minister in however many decades. And no, clearly it's been there's lots of frustrations. We've been through a lot as a country over the past few years, which people are understandably frustrated about and makes the environment trickier. But I'm entirely confident that there are better times ahead. All the things that I've been working hard on for the last year, I think you can start to see are making a difference. That change is starting to become more apparent in people's lives. And that's what gives me optimism about the future.
Right, and actually we must come on to that, but on the political optimism, John Curtis, the great election expert, who I have to take seriously because he was my tutor at Oxford 40 years ago. So I always follow what John Curtis says. He says this week there's now a 99% chance of Labour being in government after the election. You know, because even if there was a hung parliament, he says they would find it easier to form agreements with other parties and things like that. So is it possible to enlarge that 1%? You know, for your Conservative supporters like me, how are you going to enlarge that 1%
yes,
chance?
I do. Look, one thing I'd say is we've had plenty of predictions about elections and referendums in the past few years which have turned out to be wrong.
Yeah.
So we should always remember that. And, you know, what I detect when I'm out and about across the country, I understand there's an enormous amount of frustration because it's not been easy. But I also detect a very strong sense that people feel things are getting better. And I think when you get to an election, people will be squarely focused on the question on, you know, going forward, you know, who is better placed to deliver the change that they want to see in their lives, right? And I actually think when we get into an election and that is the question that people are squarely focused on, that's one that we can answer very well.
So that's what you'll be trying to show in the election campaign and how you relate to people, right? Because I know from Yorkshire, from a common background in Yorkshire, I used to take you out around some of those villages in the early days. You are really good at relating to people and caring about people. And I remember one of my favourite stories is you telling me you were going milking the cows early the next morning and me saying, you don't really have to do that, you know. You're saying, no, I really want to understand what people's lives are like. But that's going to be a big challenge, isn't it? Because, you know, you're the prime minister there. You can't get to know everybody in the country. They'll say, well, he doesn't have to worry about money and he doesn't have to, you know, he's there in the government and all the things people do say.
Yeah.
I hope you're really going to make sure in that election you show how you relate to people.
Yeah. No, and you know, you're right to talk about actually when I first came to Richmond in North Yorkshire. Obviously, it's different to where I grew up from. Actually, my, you know, very fond memories of those first few months. Obviously, farming was not something that was in my background, so I spent a lot of time with our farmers at our auction marts, making sure I had a good understanding of what they needed from me as their MP. And actually, that's why when you were giving me career advice about getting into Parliament, I got myself on the, you know, EFRA Select Committee, the Agricultural Rural Affairs Select Committee, which people were a bit puzzled by because they assumed I would try and go for something on the Treasury side or business side or education and my other passions. But actually, that's what I wanted to focus on because that was what was important to everyone at home. These are all things that have shaped me, to your point, about understanding in the different aspects of our country. And ultimately, I'm a product of my upbringing, right? I grew up in a family where, you know, hard work was prioritised. Education was the thing that, you know, my parents focused on as a means to unlock opportunity. We had a small business that I grew up working in and everything that that means. And those are the values that shaped who I am. And then what I'd say to people is to judge me by my actions. I think most people got to know me when I became Chancellor. And 3 weeks later, there was a pandemic and I stood up and announced the furlough scheme. And all those things that you just said about me were true at that moment too.
Yes.
But that didn't mean that I didn't recognise the right thing at that moment was to find a way to support people's jobs. And you've seen over the last year, with support for people's energy bills, support for cutting people's taxes, raising the national living wage, expanding childcare to working parents, raising the state pension. Those are my actions that I think demonstrate the things that I think are important and what the country needs.
So that's going to be a large part of your message in the election. And what about just a word about the state of the Conservative Party through that election? This week, two respected ministers announced they were standing down, Robert Halfon and James Heapey. If you won the election, would it be possible to rebuild the expertise of the Conservative Party?
Yeah, no, of course. I'm sad to see James and Robert leave Parliament, and they've announced that previously, and now they're stepping down for their ministerial jobs. But we're really blessed. I've got lots of talented colleagues who are able to contribute to public life, and the party is broad, and we're making sure that we attract lots of great people to stand. And so I'm very confident about that. That's not something I worry about at all.
And will it stick together? It's always attributed to me, although I don't think I said it, that the Conservative Party only has two modes, complacency or panic, and they veer between the two. And you've got local elections coming up, 2nd of May. Are they going to go into one of their panics at that point?
You look at these local elections, actually, they're a great opportunity for us as a party to focus on what we should be doing, which is highlighting the difference between Conservatives in local government and the opposition, right? And you've got great local mayors, Andy Street being a fantastic example in the West Midlands, who's delivering housing in the right places, attracting investment. Teesside up near us in North Yorkshire, Ben Houchen, another great mayor. Labour neglected that area. You'll remember this because it's next to where we live for decades. And Ben is, again, creating Freeport, Treasury attracted, new campus in Darlington, investing in high streets and town centres, from Hartlepool to Stockton to Redcar. That is the contrast. And that's actually what these local elections should be about. It's a chance for us to highlight those differences and what the reality of Labour in power means.
And the and after that, at some point, you come to a general election. You can always tell the podcast listeners when it's going to be, if you fancy that. There are various ways of announcing a general election. But assuming you're not going to do that, there's a general election that's, you know, before long. And let's talk about that optimism that you mentioned about the economy and turning. You said recently the economy is turning a corner. But the biggest for you, I think, in the general election, you've got several huge problems, haven't you? One is the Conservatives have been in power for 14 years, one way or another. Then we've had multiple prime ministers, and people will be judging the party by them as well as by you. And then living standards have actually fallen for many people in recent times. Now, that is there are many good signs that's turning around, that wages will be rising faster than prices in the coming months, that the national income is starting to grow. But is that going to be happening fast enough for people to feel optimistic? And do you think it will be sustained? You know, is this turning the corner for several years to come for Britain?
Yeah. So we've got to recognise that we've been through a tough few years, right? As we've just been talking about, like that's real impact on people. It's living standards. When inflation's at 11%, your energy bills have more than doubled, right? Then all of that, and you've had the impact of a pandemic. Like that is a significant shock to the country, or two shocks in a short space of time. And I don't think anyone, certainly not me, would expect everyone to overnight suddenly say, great, everything's hunky-dory again. Of course it will take time, but I do think that we're now heading in the right direction. And it's because I took the time to do these things carefully. Inflation is, as I said, all the forecasts suggest that it will be back to target in a matter of months, very positive. Energy bills falling by hundreds of pounds, childcare being expanded, taxes being cut by £900, estate pension going up by £900. These are all very real changes for those people who have been impacted by what's called the high income child benefit charge. That we've cut that tax too. That's a £1,300 tax cut benefit for 500,000 families with young children. You know, these are real meaningful changes which are all starting to add up and happen over the coming days and weeks. And as I said, because we've done it in a careful and responsible way, the Chancellor and I, people will know that it's sustainable.
And can you say a word about the people in their 20s and 30s who they've become known as Generation Rent? You know, there are people in their 30s still living with their parents, people who pay half their income in rent, which is a different situation from when we were in our 20s and 30s on the whole, in terms of creating a property-owning democracy. Why should they vote Conservative in the coming election?
It's an important question. And when I think about what's the type of country that I'm trying to build, it's one where ambition and aspiration is celebrated. And that applies to you whether you want to own your own home or start a business and pass it on to your kids. You and I remember what it felt like to get the keys to our first flat. You know, it's a special moment. Of course, I want as many people as possible to experience that. And it has been more challenging over not just the last few years. It's becoming more challenging. It's become more challenging over time. You know, what are we doing to alleviate it? Well, A, we're delivering on the housing targets that we set ourselves over this parliament. We said we'd build 1 million homes in this parliament, and we are on track to deliver that. So that's the supply side of it. And then we're making it easier for people to get on the housing ladder, first-time buyers. So we've cut stamp duty for first-time buyers. So if you're buying a home up to, I think, £425,000 now is the exact number, I think, you don't pay any stamp duty as a first-time buyer. And that means that something like 80% of first-time buyers don't pay any stamp duty at all. So again, you know, we're making progress, but the job is clearly not done. And, you know, one of the things I was frustrated by is that we found a way to change some outdated and ineffective EU rules that were stymieing the development of 100,000 homes in places where local communities wanted them and actually had approved them for planning in most cases, but they were being blocked by this legacy EU rule that actually did nothing to improve the environment but just stymied house building. And we were going to change that, and the Labour Party blocked it in the House of Lords. And, you know, that was frustrating because that is probably the single most significant thing that we could do in the short term to increase the supply of housing so that many more young people could enjoy what you and I experienced. And it was blocked by the Labour Party in the House of Lords, which was very frustrating.
Coming up.
My kids are exactly that age where they've just got their phones and we're grappling with all of that at home. So it is quite instructive time to be thinking about it as Prime Minister at the same time as going through it as a parent.
That's in just a moment.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Prime Minister, elections are, of course, largely a judgment on the past. That's what voters have to go on. But what they will really change one way or another is the future of the country. And I think you've seen some of the papers I've done with Tony Blair,
yes.
Which are where we call for a new national purpose, where we say so much is going to change in the world, in artificial intelligence, in biotechnology, so in robotics, in so many other fields that this country really has to be very quickly at the, make sure it's at the forefront of all of that, or we would get left behind. And you've actually done a lot of the things we've been calling for, or that you've decided to do yourself. Often with people saying, "Why is he doing that? There's no votes in that." You know, setting up a Department of Science and Innovation and an AI frontier task force, and your emphasis on mathematics. But are we going big enough on all of that? It's easy for Tony Blair and me. We don't have to find the money. We sit, the old guys, you know, telling you what to do, or telling Keir Starmer what to do, because, you know, well, this is addressed to both parties. But are we going big enough? Saudi Arabia has just announced $40 billion of spending on artificial intelligence. And we've got to be right up there with all of that. If you were starting with a fresh mandate and a majority, you know, not taking over in the middle of a parliament with chaos going on, is this something where you would really go big?
You know, in a word, yes.
Good.
Because, in a word, yes. Because I agree with what you said at the beginning, which we're about to go through an era of unprecedented change where AI in particular is going to change every facet of our lives. And it's important that, you know, me as a leader and us as a government are able to make sure that the country is prepared for that and can seize all the benefits of it, not for kind of geekery's sake so we can win lots of Nobel Prizes and talk about science a lot, but so that it can deliver practical benefits for people, create jobs and opportunity, drive economic growth, but then also make sure public services are delivered more efficiently and productively, whether that's radically changing how education is delivered in our country to improve how our kids learn, you know, make sure teachers' jobs are that much more fulfilling, make sure that healthcare is improved as well and people get the diagnosis and the treatment they need quicker. That, you know, all these things are available in the not too distant future, and some of them are already starting to happen. So look, I think it's incredibly important. The scale of change is unlike anything we've seen probably since the Industrial Revolution. It's happening even faster than that did. And so, look, I'm really excited about all of this, but I think the question the country should be asking is, this is coming, and who's best placed to lead us through it?
Yeah, and I want to get, you're talking knowledgeably and passionately about that. I'm going to ask Keir Starmer to come on one of these podcasts and also talk about the future, because it seems to me that life will change more in the next parliament or the next two parliaments than in the previous 10 or 15 parliaments.
I think that is
so
absolutely
this
right.
This is going to be really critical importance.
And I think that's right. And people may not appreciate just what is happening or about to happen. It may not be the most electorally significant issue, but it ought to be uppermost in people's mind, because this is coming, and it's coming over the next 5 to 10 years. And it's important that we seize the benefits of it. And your papers talk about this with Tony Blair. What are the building blocks for making sure that that happens? Are we investing in R&D? I protected that as Chancellor, and we're increasing it significantly. Is our tax system rewarding those companies that are investing in innovation? Do we have a visa regime that is, yes, bringing down levels of legal migration, mass migration, and tackling the small boats issue, but also remaining open to genuinely the world's most talented people to come here and start companies? Have we reformed all our capital markets so those growing companies get the money they need to keep growing?
Well, that's
is
it,
our regulation
was
right?
Taken over by Google in America.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And
that's
why.
And we need British firms that do this.
And actually, one of the things that the Chancellor announced in the budget was a British ISA, where there'll be a new extra tax treatment in the ISA system to invest in British companies. And also investing in the computing power that we need. Which we're in a, you've described it, I think, in the past, as there's kind of almost an arms race for getting that processing power. And we're investing in that in Cambridge and in Bristol and in Edinburgh with new supercomputers. So look, you need someone. This all might sound a bit technical, but unless we get all those things right, then we won't have the high quality performing NHS that we want. We won't have the best education system in the world. We won't create the jobs and opportunities that are there waiting for us to seize, because you know what? We're really good at this. We've got more large technology companies in this country than France, Germany, and Sweden combined, right? There's more AI research happening here anywhere outside of the US and China. This is the only place where the large AI companies have their European headquarters. So we have all the ingredients we need, actually, to be brilliant at this and to give people a sense of optimism about our future. But you do need to understand it and then put in place the right policies. And, your and Tony Blair's papers, to be fair to him as well, actually have been really instructive in this regard.
Good. We're glad we're performing a good service to the Prime Minister and future Prime Ministers. And what about some of the downsides of technology? You've been taking action on vaping, on children vaping, and indeed on smoking. But now many people are worried about the screen time of children. You've got young children.
Yes.
Would you like to see a ban on social media for young people, or how do you think about it?
Yeah, this? I mean, I think about it first and foremost as a dad, actually. My kids are exactly that age where they've just got their phones and we're grappling with all of that at home. So it is quite instructive time to be thinking about it as Prime Minister at the same time as going through it as a parent. And there's a couple of things that we have done. Recently, we made some announcements on tackling the use of mobile phones in school.
Although a lot of schools had already stopped that.
But a lot had still came and spoken to us and said we need more support in how best to do that. And that's why we've published new guidance. And the other thing was the Online Safety Bill, which was a complex piece of legislation. We're one of the first countries in the world to do it. That gives our regulator very tough new powers to make sure that our kids are protected online, so they're not being exposed to harmful content. None of this is easy, but we really need to get on and make sure that that bill is implemented. The regulator sets out the codes of conduct. We can define all the types of harmful content and then make sure that they're being removed and kids aren't giving access to them. And the regulator has powers to fine these large social media companies quite significantly. Look, so those are the areas of focus. But more broadly, I spoke to about inspiring people. I spoke to Molly Russell's dad and Brianna Guy's mother just the other week about this issue. And those are two people who have got thoughts based on their own family experiences about what we should be doing. And that was a very instructive conversation for me. And I've been reflecting on some of the things that they said to me as well.
I think it will become a bigger issue. I think something really profound has happened to the mental health of young people. So I'm sure that all the parties will have to come back to it. Let's just, as we get into the later stage of this discussion, foreign affairs, there's a couple of things on foreign affairs I'd love to ask you
about.
One is the American election is coming up, a bigger world event, even than our election, of course. I wouldn't expect any prime minister to say who they want to win. The prime minister works with anybody who's president. But are you concerned about the state of American democracy, that whoever wins, there may be a crisis of legitimacy, of the acceptance of the result in America?
I'm generally an optimist on these things, so I'm confident that those things will work through. Look, clearly the scenes that we saw last time around were shocking, but look, in general, I'm confident and optimistic about these things. But I do think it's a reminder we can't take these things for granted, actually. Like, we're very lucky in our country. We've got a strong democratic tradition, a strong set of values about freedom of speech, tolerance, respect, parliamentary sovereignty. And actually, I made a speech a few weeks ago on the steps of Downing Street commenting on the situation here. And unfortunately, what we've seen over the past few months in our country is a small minority of people trying to hijack our normal processes for extremist ends and undermining the values that we all hold dear. And I think we need to confront that robustly as we are.
There's no freedom in China. And this week you've been handling all the evidence of hacking on a massive scale, of espionage by China. Do we now have to find a new balance between trade and security?
I think you'll know this from your own experience. I mean, China's approach has changed over time. And the China that I'm dealing with is one that is increasingly assertive abroad, authoritarian at home, and it represents the biggest state-based threat to our economic security. And it's incumbent on us to take, again, strong action to counter that, and that's what we're doing. And again, my track record as Prime Minister and just before, what have we done? We've used our new national security investment powers to block Chinese investment into our sensitive semiconductor sector. We've ensured that the Chinese state nuclear enterprise is not going to be involved in our nuclear industry. At Sizewell, before that, we made a decision to remove Huawei kit from our telecoms network. And you talk about trade, actually, we're less reliant on trade with China than many of our close allies and partner countries. So in one sense, we're in a much better place on that. And we've also passed new laws to tighten up our export controls. So actually making sure that we are careful about the types of technologies that we allow to be exported to China, more so than, again, many of our allied countries. So we've taken, I think, actually, probably we're on the robust end of responding to the challenge and the risk that China poses. And that's the right thing to do.
Florida just banned TikTok. That's definitely on the robust end. Again, can you see us doing that while the Chinese are hoovering up all our data?
So we've already done that on government devices.
Yes.
So that we did that anyway. And then separately, without commenting on individual companies, I think I'll just give people the reassurance that we are always making sure that the high standards we expect of data security and privacy are respected and protected. And if we ever thought that was at risk, then we obviously would take action to mitigate against that.
Final few thoughts. I mentioned I now get on quite well with Tony Blair, my old enemy, my old rival. What do you think of Keir Starmer? What do you make of him as a person?
Yeah, well, I don't actually know him. I don't know him very well. And you'll know, actually, you don't know these people necessarily.
How their brain works
across a dispatch box.
You're always thinking Prime Minister's questions. What is he going to say to this? Is he going to ask about that?
I think, look, whatever you mentioned Tony Blair, whatever people might think of Tony Blair and different political views and all the rest of it, I think you have to acknowledge, as I do, like, he had a clear idea of what he was going to do with the country. You knew where he stood. Actually, Europe being a case in point, agree with it or disagree with it, you know, he had a view about European integration and the single currency. If it wasn't for you in particular and a couple of others, that would have happened most likely. But probably one of your proudest achievements is making sure that happened.
But keeping the pound.
At least you knew what you knew what he stood for. You knew what he was about. I think it's tough, actually. You know, what do I think of Keir Starmer? Because I don't know that. It's hard to know what what he stands for, what he believes. I mean, this was a guy who a few years ago genuinely thought, not once but twice, Jeremy Corbyn would be the great prime minister for our country. He wanted to take us back into the EU after the referendum, believed in free movement. You know, but it's hard to know what he thinks, so it's hard to come to a view on...
I'll try to ask him. I'm definitely going to ask him on his podcast, and we'll try to ask him those things. And what about... when I stepped out of politics for a while, I wrote a couple of historical biographies. I'm not hoping you're stepping out of politics, but if you in the future wrote a biography, who would you be writing about?
I have to tell you, who's going to do the definitive Hague biography? Your own. I'll volunteer myself for that. I think, politically,
try living. It doesn't have to be a politician.
No, I'd say politically, probably Nigel Lawson is the one. I mean, he's written a hefty tome.
He's a real doorstopper of a book, exactly.
But so I could do the shorter version. He's someone I always admired. And when I was Chancellor, I had a picture of him up behind me in the study, which current Chancellor has kept. And I should try to follow very much his approach of controlling public spending and getting inflation down first. That was what him and Margaret Thatcher believed. And then get on to cutting taxes. So we've kind of followed that Thatcherite, Lawsonian blueprint. So I'm a big admirer of his, always have been. And then, but I think probably more personally, I would love to take the time to understand a little bit more about my grandparents and their story and their journey. My grandmother, my grandparents largely went from India to East Africa, and then my parents and grandparents then came from East Africa to the UK as immigrants. And I think when my grandmother made that journey, I think it was one of the first, probably perhaps one of the first times she'd herself been on a plane, I think. I think she didn't know when she was going to see her family again. I mean, she had come not quite knowing how that would all work, what she was going to do, and she kind of had to come here and set up a life for them to come and follow. And then they obviously have built a life over a couple of generations, and here I am sitting in, you know, Margaret Thatcher's study in Downing Street, not that long thereafter. And that is an incredibly, you know, I'm inspired by that, and that's something that speaks to our country and our country.
It is a great thing about our country.
Yeah,
and probably wouldn't be true of many countries across Europe.
I think there's very few countries in the world where my story would be possible, and I think that speaks to our country's story, that ability to integrate people, that openness and tolerance, but a set of values that everyone needs to subscribe to about hard work and putting in and sharing the same set of values. And, you know, my family story was one of hard work and strong, loving family and service to a community. Those are things that are important to me, and those are the values that I was raised with. But I'd probably like to understand a little bit more where all of that came from.
And final question then, having had that extraordinary experience, whenever and whoever there's a new prime minister, what is your top bit of advice to them? And they walk in that door, whoever it is, and you say, the thing you need to know about being prime minister is...
Well, get some sleep and a holiday before you take the job would be my first bit.
That's not normally how it starts, no. Though, is it?
I think probably what I would say is, I think it's important to have a focused set of priorities and a clear idea of what you're trying to do, because the job buffets you day to day in lots of different directions. And unless you have a very clear set of priorities that you can be held accountable for and you can measure yourself against and that you're going to achieve, you will get blown off course. And that's why, actually, slightly, I said it was atypical for Prime Minister to do this, but I was very clear. I said to the country, here are five things that I'm going to focus on: halve inflation, grow the economy, reduce debt, cut waiting lists and stop the boats. And as I said, we were talking earlier, on all of those things, you know, yes, things were tough, but we're making progress on all of them. And that's what gives me the confidence for the future.
Well, thank you for having it as a priority to talk to the podcast listeners of The Times and Sunday Times.
It's been a great pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Thank you very much indeed. Today's producer was Olivia Case. The executive producers are Kate Ford and Fiona Leach. Sound design was by David Crackles. And I'm William Hague. I'll be back on the last Friday of every month with some of the world's key newsmakers and thinkers. Do leave us a review. It helps others to find us. And if you'd like to get in touch, our email is thestory@thetimes.co.uk. See you again soon.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.